Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Do cupcakes make you smile? I bet they do. And I bet you don't even have to eat one to get the same effect. Public art with cupcakes coming up later today. Can you imagine modern life without chocolate and tobacco? Well, there was a time when they weren't used by everyone in the modern world. How a couple from two different cultures have made exploring food the glue that holds them together, plus the dying art of a perfect consommé. But first, let's see what's in season at the legendary Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're so happy to be able to catch up with David Karp, who's here again at the Farmers Market in between his extensive research travels. David is a well-known fruit expert. He is officially called a pomologist. He's also very closely associated with the UC Riverside Citrus Collection, and he is now once again going to be writing stories for Russ Parsons in the LA Times. We're so excited. So, David, you have just finished quite a lot of research on the small yet not insignificant kumquat. These are basically bite-sized citrus fruits.
Well, some of them are a little bit big for a bite. Okay. Some of them are you actually need a couple of them. They're the size of an olive. And unlike most citrus, where you discard the peel and eat the flesh inside, in case of a kumquat, you pop it in your mouth. You spit out the seeds in most cases, because they're usually are seeds. But the typical kind that's grown on some 133 acres in California, and you would not believe what I went through to get that statistic, but the kumquat is most remarkable for its size, for being eaten whole, and for its flavor, which is just mind-boggling. So this is how I write about it in my article, which will be out shortly in the LA Times. Trained sensory analysts detect a fresh, citrusy odor and pungent taste to begin, followed by green and woody notes with a persistent, oily undertone and a sweet apricot-like aftertaste. Isn't that mind-boggling? And I never could have come up with all of that directly myself because I'm not a trained sensory analyst, but I sort of compiled it from various different professionals.
So my experience of kumquat is really sour, then really sweet.
But that's the Nagami, which has grown on 90% plus of the acreage.
Okay.
Then, of course, there's the Mewa, which they're round.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually considerably larger, and they're much sweeter. They have that delicious tropical banana flavor. They have a lot less juice on the inside, a thicker skin. And Nagamis, you can only eat a few because they're quite tart, actually.
Right.
Mewas you can actually snack on, and they're one of the best-kept secrets because they're only grown on a few acres.
And it was Armando Garcia who introduced those kumquats from his dad's nursery, the one he manages, to our market. And otherwise, we would never know about them.
Exactly. Now, there are a couple of other oddball kumquats that are just starting to show up. Steve Smith of Mud Creek Ranch and his wife, Robin, are like a mini experiment station up there on the Ojai-Santa Paula Road. And they've got this. Look at this. It's a large, round kumquat that is actually, it's the Fukushu. It's marketed as a kumquat, but it's really a hybrid of mandarin and kumquat. He also has a few trees, and let's describe this. It is a teardrop or pear-shaped Nagami-like fruit that's otherwise pretty much the same, but there's one thing that's extraordinary about it. Can you please take a bite?
Yes, of course.
Notice anything unusual about it?
No seeds.
No seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may not be a big deal to you if you're not a kumquat maven. But
delicious.
If you have ever been a prep kitchen in a restaurant when the boss said, hey, see these 20 pounds of kumquats? That's like 500 kumquats. De-seed them. What everybody does is they say, hey, you, I did them last time. It's your turn.
Right. Now, who else has these? Is it just the Smiths?
Hardly anybody grows them down here. I don't know. It's a mystery.
Now these kumquats, which we have here at the market, they sell like in little strawberry baskets, about a pint. How much are they? Like $3?
They're really $3 or $4.
Very reasonable.
They're used in a lot of desserts because they're just flavor bombs. They're so complex and intense, and they're beautiful.
All right, so we are so excited. We're going to see your work again in the LA Times, where it belongs. And thanks a lot for the wonderful taste of these great little kumquats.
Thanks so much, Laura.
To get another idea of what to cook today at the market, we're visiting with Josiah Citron, who, of course, is the chef owner of Melisse right here in Santa Monica and also co-owner of Lemon Moon out on Olympic and Bundy. Josiah, so share with us maybe something that you're going to be buying and cooking either for yourself or for the restaurant.
Yeah, I've kind of been having fun at home cooking roasted chickens with wilted greens and roasted fingerling potatoes. Greens are great right now. You have the dandelion greens, the mustard greens, the escarole, the wild arugula, mixing them all together. and just wilting them down, barely cooking them down, really just a little bit. Just, I like to do it with a little bit of olive oil and brown butter to bring a little nuttiness to it. You know, you have the pan juice from whatever you roasted off and the juices from the potatoes all together. It really makes a nice, you know, kind of country-style meal.
How do you make that brown butter?
You take a couple pounds of butter, you brown it.
How do you do that?
You just put it in a pan and just cook it till the bubbles and it just becomes brown. Not black, but brown. Really, but really nice and nutty flavor. You'll smell it. And then after that, when it's done, you take it off, let it cool a little bit, and then you pour it through a cheesecloth or a coffee filter and strainer, and it'll come through. And then you have just this beautiful brown butter, clear brown butter, like clarified brown butter. Mm-hmm. Then you just pop that in the freezer.
Okay, like an ice cube tray.
It's like an ice cube tray, exactly. Ooh. Then you just have it for all the time. We finish lots of sauces with it. We saute mushrooms in it. It's just the flavor is so much nicer to me than just regular, you know, butter. And then this way, you just throw it in the pan with that. Mm-hmm. And you put the greens in, the butter melts down.
Now, how many of these greens, how do you know when you're supposed to take the stem off? Because sometimes I'll cook a kale, and then you get that stem in there, and you just can't chew it.
You should take the stem off all of them.
And how? What's the best way to get the stem off?
Break the stems off.
Okay.
Then use a scissors, probably, and just clip it at the bottom, right where the leaf starts.
When do you add that brown butter, at the beginning or the end?
In the beginning.
And then throw the greens into that.
Throw the greens in that with a little olive oil.
Some olive oil.
Put some garlic in there. They just wilt down. But you don't want them too cooked either. Just kind of wilted, nicely wilted.
So how long would that take for these nice hearty greens?
Between 15 seconds to a minute.
Oh, okay.
So it's
super fast.
It's fast, yeah.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. All right, Josiah, that's great. And tell us again, now where's Melise located?
Melise is located in Santa Monica on Wilshire Boulevard, 1104 Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica.
Fine French dining, really nice. And it's nice to come across something simple, easy, and elegant that we can do at home. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can see what Laura Avery just talked about. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for info and for pictures. I want to take a second to thank all of you who subscribed to KCRW during the last two weekends during Good Food. This little one-hour show raised a combined total of $70,000 from 500 people. Unprecedented. We even broke the pledge drive system during the last weekend. Thanks to you all. It's impossible not to acknowledge Valentine's Day. It's today, of course. Food and matters of the heart are so intertwined. Love accounts for more weight gain and loss than any actual food substance. I mean, forget about high fructose corn syrup. The government should regulate falling in love. We asked you all about what food comforts you when you're suffering from heartbreak, and here's what you said.
Hello, my name is Alexis, and I'm from originally from Florida. Now I live in California. My ultimate comfort food comes from me and my sister and my mother. We'd always eat barbecue chips and cottage cheese as the dip. And I don't know, to this day, whenever I'm upset or sad or happy, and it's the first food I want to eat. And everyone else thinks it's gross, but the three of us, we'll get, whenever we're all together, we'll get one of those giant tubs of cottage cheese and some really good barbecue chips. Right now, since I was in Florida, I'm in California, I'm on the Trader Joe's chips, the Hawaiian ones, but we'll just sit around and we'll eat it all together, and it's just pure comfort and pure good.
Hi, my name's Brent, and I live in San Francisco, and the foods I associate with heartbreak and heartache are the foods that I would probably avoid when in a relationship. So I would say the stinky things, like lots of garlic and green onions and fermented soybeans and fermented tofu and dried fish and dried scallops. Stinky things.
My name is Bria Silbert, and my comfort food is a tuna sandwich with a good piece of tomato, crunchy lettuce on very good rye bread. Cut in half, please.
My name is Kristen. I live in Los Angeles, and when I'm heartbroken, I don't eat until I run out of the energy to even cry anymore, and then I eat whole wheat toast with margarine and strawberry jelly instantly. That is also what I eat when I'm physically ill.
Elizabeth Stevens, Manhattan, Kansas. When I'm feeling down or heartbroken, I reach for chocolate, and specifically, I really like chocolate pudding. Basically, I like it fresh out of the pot and warm. I don't really like it to cool down. It may be symbolic of how I feel, but since I look like a wreck when I'm heartbroken, it's sort of appropriate to eat this kind of gooey, sticky, messy thing. It helps me heal from the inside out.
My name's Melissa Adelia Gutierrez, and I'm calling from Los Angeles, California. What I usually eat when I have a broken heart, mashed potatoes and gravy. And if I can't get a hold of that, I do something as simple as I did last night, because I was dealing with a broken heart, a glass of Calvados and some gorgeous cheeses. And then I'm always, always made happy with a bag of pork rinds and a bottle of champagne while soaking in the tub. So that's that. Happy Valentine's Day. Hopefully my broken heart will mend and I won't have to keep drinking all this champagne alone. Okay, bye-bye.
One thing you probably shouldn't be eating for a little while is peanut butter. Here we go with yet another food contamination scare. I'll be right back with the truth, the lies, and the analysis. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Well, it's time for another nightmare food recall, this time in the uniquely insidious form of peanut paste, which brings us to another conversation with Marion Nessel, our favorite food issue detective. She's a highly respected professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. Her latest book is Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine. Hi, Marion.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm disturbed that it seems that peanut butter and peanut paste is in absolutely everything.
Isn't it amazing? Who knew? Who knew that peanut butter was in so many products? And who knew that they were all produced at exactly the same factory, one that seems to have very sloppy sanitary practices? This is an exact repeat of the pet food recall of 2 years ago.
Give us an idea of the scope of the problem.
Well, the scope is phenomenal. I think about 400 products have been recalled, because this plant sent out two different kinds of peanut butter. It sent out bulk peanut butter to institutions like schools and nursing homes and places like that where people got sick. Those were the first people who got sick. And then it turns out it makes peanut butter paste that goes into peanut butter crackers. It goes into ice cream. It goes into cookies. It goes into the most extraordinary number of products, including pet food, which is another example of how the pet food supply and the human food supply are one and the same.
There have been so many recalls in this case. How effective are they in such a diffused food product like this?
Well, forget it. They're not effective at all. My son in Los Angeles called and said, "Hey, I have these peanut butter crackers in my desk drawer. I've had them since June. Can I eat them?" I don't know whether he can eat them or not. It depends on, you know, what the code numbers are. But who reads code numbers? Safest approach is not to eat anything with peanut butter in it, except the jars are supposed to be okay, because the people who put peanut butter into jars do their own roasting and their own grinding, apparently. And they didn't come through this massive centralized plant. So it's another example of how the centralization of our food supply causes really serious problems when something goes wrong. And it's another example of how all these different brands that are trying so hard to distinguish themselves are really all the same and come from the same place. What shocks me is I'm on a feed from an organization that sort of tracks this kind of thing and sends out daily news alerts on recalls, and each day there are 40 new products. And what this is about is that the FDA doesn't have recall authority. So the FDA can't go to all of these companies and say, "We are recalling every single peanut butter product on the market that got peanut butter from this country, from this company." They have to go to each individual company that got that peanut butter ingredient and say, please, pretty please, would you recall, pretty please?
It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous beyond belief and very scary. I put this squarely at the feet of Congress. This is a Congress issue. The FDA does what Congress tells it to. And for the last decades, Congress has been telling the FDA not to bother enforcing food regulations.
So that means it's actually our issue.
Oh, it's taxpayers' issues. You want to do something about this? You scream to your congressional representative. There's one congressional representative, Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut, who's introduced a bill to try to do something about the food safety situation. Everybody should be supporting that bill.
So let's talk for a minute about this company, the Peanut Corporation of America, the company that's responsible for this tainted peanut butter. Now, my understanding is that this guy, the head of it, was a member of a board that's supposed to be a standards board.
Oh, it's the most amazing thing. That has to do with peanuts in general. And he was appointed to be on a committee that's mostly industry representatives. And this is through USDA. USDA gets involved. I mean, this is why we need a new food safety system. USDA gets involved in peanuts because peanuts can be contaminated with the mold aflatoxin that's quite toxic. And you can't ship peanuts overseas if they've got aflatoxin in them. So that's a USDA issue. The FDA deals with the human food supply and foods that are domestic, but there's not very much interaction between FDA and USDA over things like peanuts. And they had appointed people to this board who were all part of the industry, and their job is to sell more peanuts. Their job isn't to do anything about food safety.
So do you think this is finally going to be the thing that pushes the public to push Congress to create a real watchdog system?
Well, I don't know what it's going to take. I mean, I've always said that the only thing that I can think of that would get Congress's attention on this would be if a family member of some extremely high-ranking senator got sick. And then we would get action, because that seems to be the only thing that moves Congress.
Marianne, once again, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us about this particular nightmare.
My pleasure, I guess.
We often turn to Marianne Nessel for her analysis of the food system. She's a highly respected professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine is Marianne Nessel's latest book. So maybe hold off on peanut butter sandwiches for that special celebration tonight. Instead, let's turn to food writer Jonathan Gold. He's got some suggestions for tonight. Food in the Key of Love. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. The name Jonathan Gold and Valentine's Day may seem at first to be kind of oxymoronic, but I am assured that Jonathan has a special love dish to share with us this morning.
Oxymoronic? I would have thought it would have been inevitable, Evan.
That's true. That's true.
Well, I think the dish that most says love is pie.
Ooh, I agree with you.
Because, first of all, if you're having pie, somebody's made you a pie. It's a lot of work to make a pie. You know, you've got to roll it out. You've got to chill it. You've got to roll it out again. You've got to pound it. You've got to put it in. You've got to put something in the pie. And then you have pie. Everybody likes pie.
I love pie.
I, after all, tempted my wife up to my apartment for the first time 25 years ago with a fresh-baked peach pie.
You did?
I did.
Oh, my. You should win some sort of award for that. Well, I guess you did.
Yeah, and I won a splendid award. Many years of marriage. But if you're not going to make pie for somebody or somebody's not going to make pie for you, I tend towards the finger food direction. And there's a
So you can feed each other?
So you can feed each other. Vietnam, as we know, is probably the finger food king of the entire civilized world.
I didn't know that. Why?
Because the kind of Vietnamese food I like, the food is cooked and it's put in front of you, but that's only the beginning. Then you take the food and you put it onto something, and then you put something on that something, and then you wrap it up, and then you dip it in a dip that you have customized, and then you eat it or you feed each other, because it's always going to be the case that the person sitting on the other side of the table from you is going to make something that's just better than you ever did. So you get to share that way. There's a lot of back and forth.
And I would imagine that if you know exactly what your mate loves, the kind of sweet and salty and crunchy bits that would make them happy, that would be lovely to be fed that.
It would be, and it is. But I'm thinking of the category sometimes gathered under NEM, or the restaurants that serve it call themselves NEM Nung restaurants.
And what does that mean?
NEM is like a meatball, and Nung is, I don't know, what you do with a meatball, I guess. I'm sorry, my Vietnamese is non-existent as all the other languages you've heard me mangle over the years. At these restaurants, if you get the special combination plate, and here I'm recommending a place called Nem Nung Khan Hoa in the ever-beautiful city of Alhambra, you get a combination plate. And in it, you get some grilled meatballs, which are long, with herbs. You get tiny little egg rolls that are just
pencils, like.
Yeah, like it's basically wonton wrappers with maybe a half gram of dried shrimp in them. You get maybe some grilled meat with peanuts on it, and you start to assemble. The first thing you get a round of rice paper, and you dip it into a bowl of warm water, turning it slowly until it's all damp. You don't want it to be sopping. Take it out, shake it gently, put it on a plate. Then you put a little lettuce on, not too much, some shredded carrot, maybe some herbs. My beloved loves rau rám, the extremely astringent Vietnamese herb. Me, not so much. Hers, I'd put a lot on. I'd put a lot of cilantro. There's usually a few different kinds of mint. There's that beautiful purple mint, and there's Vietnamese basil, and you layer that, and then you, if you're feeling ambitious, you can put on this little noodle mat called banh hoi and put that on. Remember, you want to roll this into something very slender and elegant, so don't overdo it.
You're not going crazy with each item.
A couple leaves is fine. And then you put on either the grilled meatball, or you put on one of the egg rolls, or the meatball and the egg roll, or these beautiful little cured pork things that are good, studded with garlic and studded with whole peppercorns. And then you carefully, elegantly roll it up and sort of like burrito wrap it on the sides. It should be the size of a panatella cigar when you're done. Not too big, not too small. You dip it elegantly in this carrot fish sauce they provide, which, of course, you're going to put chili in because you need to inflame the passions, and then you hand it over.
And I have to say that if you're stumbling and fumbling and things don't come out so well, then you can just laugh together.
You can. And basically, even if it's beautiful, it still tastes exactly the same, so it's still great.
And then on Sunday, you can bake a pie together.
That would be wonderful.
Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold is with us nearly every week. He writes a popular column each week in the LA Weekly, and we're happy to get his suggestions here, too. Food isn't only solace and energy, but it can also be art. My next guest turns the cupcake into public art. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. cure the world's pain? Maybe not, but they sure can bring a smile to your face. A Seattle artist scattered cupcakes throughout her neighborhood as part of a public art installation. Jessie Olson is the artist, blogger, and baker, also known as the Cake Spy. So, Jessie, why cupcakes?
Well, I think that cupcakes are an instantly iconic figure and a symbol of something so small that can make us so happy, such a small luxury.
Now, were these freshly baked cupcakes? How did you make them?
Well, they were freshly made, but not baked. I made these cupcakes out of plaster of Paris, and I poured and dyed the plaster and poured it into silicone baking cups, and when it hardened, made a second batch of plaster and spooned it on for the frosting. Then affixed those little flags to them.
And what did the flags say?
I made them say little uplifting phrases. For instance, people like you, really. have a sweet day. And my favorite, which was one that I placed by an ATM, which said, the economy is going to be okay.
Did anybody try and eat one?
I truly hope not. Cupcake sculptures, while from the pictures they look realistic, once picked up, the weight and texture, I think, would give people a very clear indication that they were not for consumption. And also, I would hope that people wouldn't just eat something that they found on the street.
I don't mean to sound really skeptical, but I imagine that if this project were in L.A., and people saw little cupcakes and were not able to actually eat them, mm-hmm. that they might be so inclined to toss one through a window.
Wow. Well, maybe we need to do it on a bigger scale there.
So what was the reaction through the neighborhood?
I think that in Seattle, people are very open to the quirky and weird little art projects. And so I think that people saw these and were maybe perplexed, but mostly delighted to find such a small little treasure on their everyday, you know, activities.
Do you use food or cupcakes in particular in other ways in your art?
I do. Actually, by trade, I illustrate cupcakes, and I use cupcakes in a variety of different baking experiments and projects.
Now, wait. By trade, you illustrate cupcakes. You earn a living illustrating cupcakes?
Yes, I do.
Explain, please.
Well, on my website, I have a little mascot, a cupcake who's called Cuppy. And the way that I make my living is by selling original artwork, stationery, buttons, etc. with this character.
That is so fantastic.
Yeah, it's definitely definitely makes good cocktail party banter.
Now, what about the connection between baking actual food and illustrating food? Do you get a sense of artistic expression from the act of baking as well?
Oh, absolutely. I love to bake, and one of the reasons why I started my website was to try to combine my loves of baking and art and writing. So I do feel like the enjoyment that I get from all of these things really comes together.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much, Jessie. It was such a pleasure meeting you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jessie Olson is a blogger, artist, and baker, also known as the Cake Spy. Most of her art is about cupcakes. We've got some pictures of her art at kcrw.com/goodfood. Humans all across the world are addicted to both chocolate and tobacco. The intensity of the addictions these two ingredients inspire is loony. But when they were first introduced to this country, no one knew what to do with them. Learning to inhale. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Imagine a world in which chocolate and tobacco were unknown. No one relied upon chocolate to soften heartache or a pipe full of tobacco to relieve anxiety. Well before Columbus's fateful voyage to the New World, no European had ever seen either substance. So once they finally arrived, how were they assimilated? Marcy Norton is a history professor at George Washington University, and she's the author of Sacred Gifts, Profane Pleasures, A History of Tobacco and Chocolate in the Atlantic World. I'm fascinated by this moving of these two substances into, quote, European culture.
Tobacco and chocolate, among the various groups of American Indians who used them, were incredibly important on all different levels. They were socially paramount. They had sacred meanings. They were used medicinally. And when Europeans learned to use them, and that's a central argument I make in this book, is that it wasn't something that was at all automatic. They had to learn to use them. They appropriated not only the sort of material forms, but also much of the cultural forms that went along with it. And the most obvious way in which that's immediately visible is that they were important socially. So just as for Native Americans, a meeting between two new groups of people or people who maybe had some hostility between them, tobacco and chocolate, if that was something that was used in that region, could sort of smooth the way. The same kinds of meetings were also attributed among Europeans.
Before tobacco arrived in Europe, were Europeans smoking something else? Was the act of smoking, did it exist?
No, it certainly didn't exist in Europe. And that's a really good point, that when Europeans started to smoke tobacco, they weren't only using a substance that was new, but they were also partaking in a whole way of ingestion that was novel as well. One of the reasons, in fact, that I have tobacco and chocolate together in this book is that the timing of their introduction to Europe is quite unlike the timing of any other New World good. And there was a significant time lag before they show up in any systematic kind of way. So there's sort of erratic instances of them appearing, but you don't see them in trade records, for instance, until the 1590s. And that I hypothesize is because, again, they were things that needed to be learned to use. Europeans didn't have a ready-made category for the use of either good, so those categories had to be created, and only through sort of sustained interaction. So that's why it takes until really the end of the 16th century before there's something that are systematically used by Spaniards, in the case of chocolate first, and then spreading to the rest of Europe.
Can you describe the different sensory responses to both these substances and why they were so appealing?
So this is another really interesting way that Europeans learned from Mesoamericans. Chocolate was far from just a flavor or just a drug. It was something that affected all the sensory levels. One of the most important senses that was affected was the olfactory sense. And chocolate, the way Mesoamericans consumed it and later on Europeans, had what I call a floral triumvirate. The spice that we still use of those is vanilla. But there were also two other sort of tropical indigenous spices spices that were described as kind of spicy and floral. And, you know, if you think of how strong and flower-like vanilla is, you get a sense of how important that was. So that was one of the senses. There's also a visual sense, for, as I mentioned already, it wasn't just the chocolate itself, but the cups. And the chocolate was colored red, and that was also supposed to be evocative of blood. And there was also a textural quality. Mesoamerican chocolate had a foamy head on top of it that was very important. People could rate the kind of quality of the chocolate on the quality of the foam that they could find. So all of those attributes also became important to Europeans, though over time they changed somewhat. So Europeans continued to use vanilla as an important spice into the 18th century. And then they also started substituting the Mesoamerican spices with cinnamon, which had a similar kind of both floral yet spicy quality. And they too valued the foam on top of it and rated the quality accordingly. And again, of course, the visual aspect was very important as well, the sort of the fineness of the utensils that were used.
Describe the Mesoamerican association of chocolate with sexuality. Does that translate to the European culture?
Well, the quick answer is yes. In various Mesoamerican contexts, chocolate was associated with sexuality. A great example of that was there was a Mayan expression which could be literally translated as I'd be interested in marrying your daughter. And it also has the meaning, may I serve you some chocolate? And so I paraphrase here roughly. So so there is this, you know, early on a sort of aphrodisiacal association that Europeans pick up on. And then that does travel across to Europe as well. For instance, you have kind of love sonnets that are, I mean, there's one that comes to mind in particular that is actually, by our standards, probably quite risque. It sort of has a conceit about drinking chocolate, which is also described as a process of lovemaking at the same time. And you also have in sort of visual representations the kind of connections made between chocolate and sexuality. So I would say our present day, you know, Valentine's Day connection has its roots in very distant times in cultural ways that are quite significant.
So interesting. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Marcy Norton is Associate Professor of History at George Washington University. She's an expert on the history of chocolate and tobacco and the author of Sacred Gifts, Profane Pleasures, A History of Tobacco and Chocolate in the Atlantic World. Consommé. You may have heard the word, but do you know what it really is or how it's made? There's a fine art to it, and making it involves a raft. I'll explain next on Good Food here on KCRW and KCRW.com. There are few dishes as miraculous and quirky to make as consommé. Vitaly Paley is the chef at Paley's Place Bistro and Bar in Portland, Oregon. He's also the author of a beautiful book, The Paley's Place Cookbook with his wife, Kimberly. Hi, Vitaly.
Hi.
In your book, you call consommé the culinary miracle, and it absolutely is. Let's start, I guess, by describing what the final product is. What is it that you're trying to achieve? And then we'll go back and talk about the alchemy that's required.
In my opinion, the consommé is a intensely flavored clear broth.
So it isn't chicken soup?
Well, consommé or a broth can essentially be made out of any liquid. So you could start by making a stock from literally anything. Could be crab, could be venison, could be rabbit, could be pheasant. It has to have some sort of protein in it. And if you don't have protein in it, you could add a little bit more egg whites or egg shells, because proteins essentially are what binds all those impurities in the liquid that essentially form a raft. So I've made vegetable consommés before, but it'd be more difficult, obviously. You definitely need the protein.
So you used a lot of words, like we've used the word raft, and you used the word eggshells, and there are probably people thinking, I'm going to put an eggshell in a broth?
This is an ancient way. It's really one of those really incredibly classic, incredibly old, incredibly satisfying recipes, for me at least, to make. And essentially what the egg whites do in a consommé is what a winemaker, for example, would use eggshells or egg whites to clarify the wine. And so what they do is they actually take the eggshells and they break them up and they take them into this wine vat and then they let them slowly come down to the bottom and they carry the impurities with them to the bottom, see? But when you do it in a cooking process, you're actually doing just the opposite. You're letting the egg whites and eggshells bound together with some kind of a protein, whether it be meat or fish, and then you stir it into this already flavorful broth, and then the egg whites, as they rise to the top, bring the impurities with them. So the idea is to really intensify the flavors of the broth and making it beautifully clear and, in most cases, ambered hued.
I cannot tell you the number of times I have poured that mixture in and ended up with scrambled eggs, like egg drop soup. What is the process of adding the eggs in so that it does form this raft?
The process is somewhat simple. When you have a flavorful stock, you warm it up to approximately 120 degrees or so, and then you have a bowl with whisked egg whites, eggshells, usually some sort of a aromatic vegetable like carrots and onions. And whether you're making a meat or a fish, let's say consommé, you would add some ground meat or ground fish. You would season that. And so the raft making is fairly room temperature. And so you want to equalize those temperatures. And that process is called tempering, right? So you would take some of the liquid from the stock and then you would add a ladle or two into your raft forming. And then you would eventually combine the two in a soup pot and then slowly bring up the temperature. The key is really to pay attention to every step and then you will ensure the success. The mission here behind consommé is really to bring a person back into the kitchen. This is not one of those easy processes where you put something in the oven and you forget about it and you come back to it. The idea really is to understand the process and enjoy it while you're doing it, because it's really a lot of fun to observe what happens in the pot.
It's miraculous.
It is.
Is there a certain moment where all of a sudden you can actually see the clarification happening?
That is the most exciting moment, actually. When the raft starts coming up to the top, you can actually see it where it's forming a nice solid mass. And then you want to go in there and just kind of use the back of the wooden spoon and just open it up just a tiny bit and let the water escape. If you don't let the water to escape, it eventually starts folding over the sides and then bringing the raft back down, which is kind of a no-no. So you wanted to allow the mixture to come up through the raft and then come back down, kind of this percolating effect, trying to season the broth at the same time, clarify it. And it starts out as a little foam, and then eventually a few minutes later, it actually starts being clear. And that's the most amazing point.
And then once you finally have it, you have this beautiful, clear, super flavorful broth. How do you like to serve it?
There are several preparations we do, and it all depends, of course, on the season. So, for example, at this time of year, if we were to make a consommé out of oxtail, let's say, we would flavor it with some root vegetables, and then you would shave some fresh truffles into it, and it would be absolutely dramatic looking, and the flavor would be out of this world. In the spring, it's wonderful to do it with asparagus and morels.
Mm. Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much. The book is beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is a wonderful opportunity. Thank you.
Vitaly Paley is the chef at Paley's Place Bistro and Bar in Portland, Oregon. He's also the author of the Paley's Place Cookbook with his wife, Kimberly Paley. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a consommé recipe. Travel through Cuba, and it's common to eat in a stranger's home. These are called paladares, and they represent a slice of capitalism in an otherwise anti-capitalist environment. The concept hasn't caught on much here, but more people are creating secret supper clubs to satisfy the itch to own a restaurant. Next, a former restaurant owner starts her own club. Stay tuned to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Somewhere in Eagle Rock, a secret club has formed. It's the Secret Supper Club, hosted by Deep Tron, founder of Blue Hen Restaurant in Eagle Rock. Deep opens her home on random nights to 26 people who gather together by invite only for a fabulous meal. Sound intriguing? Well, we thought so too, so we've asked her here today to tell us about it. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So this Secret Supper Club, how did it all begin?
I sold Blue Hen about 2 years ago, and what I didn't realize is when I stopped cooking for a restaurant, I got really depressed because I came from like cooking for 100, 150, 200 people a day to just cooking for myself, and it just wasn't that satisfying. And so I called up all my friends and I said, I need to cook for some people, so why don't you guys come over? And it just started out really small, and then it just kind of burgeoned that, like, we want to invite our friends. And I said, well, it's my home, so I don't really want weird people. But I have this process where you can only come if you get invited by somebody I know. And then after you come for the first time, and I think you're fine, you're sane, then you are allowed to invite folks as well.
And is there a monetary exchange?
Yes, you know, I mean, you don't, some people like come and like, oh, we didn't think to pay or, and I said, well, you know, just give whatever, you know, so it's like more of a courtesy thing. And so people pay more or less.
Yeah, it's just to help you pay for your ingredients.
Yeah, yeah.
How often do you host the supper club now?
I do it about once a month. It happens around once a month. And it's just whatever inspires me. And usually I don't send out the invitation until I like figure out the menu. And sometimes the menu takes like a day and sometimes it'll take like 2 weeks because I can't decide. So, but yeah, it's about once every month. It actually started out in my living room that I turned into like a mini dining room. And then it kind of now we do alfresco seating because it's gotten too big.
Do people bring their own wine?
Yes, they bring it. Yeah, I said, I don't, you know.
Yeah.
BYOB, because I don't want to even have to like deal with that.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
So give me an idea of a couple different menus that you've done.
Every once in a while, I go back to my roots and I do a Vietnamese menu. I'm from the north, North Vietnam, so I do a lot of northern dishes.
Like what?
Like a turmeric galangal glazed fish, and I tried two different kinds of fish and with like a table salad. And I started out with a really rustic appetizer, which is just corn on the cob, but dressed with scallions and a little bit of fish sauce and oil just brushed on top.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And then I always like to tweak it a little bit. I call my food like new old fashioned. So it's like, it's definitely rooted in the recipes and the dishes that I learned from my grandparents, but it's just like with a little, like a modern twist or using more local ingredients. And I like to think I'm not tethered by tradition, but informed by it.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. That's really a great way of putting it. So I understand that hosting underground dinners runs in your family.
Yes. You know, it's funny that underground restaurants are like the rage. And I didn't really start it knowing that it was a rage in a way. But my grandparents were from Vietnam, came here after the fall of Saigon. And my grandmother was this businesswoman, like this terrific businesswoman in Vietnam. She came here and she was plunked into a town called Aurora, Colorado, mm-hmm. which is a suburb of Denver. And so she told my grandpa, like, we just can't sit here and do nothing. And also she wanted to have some discretionary money. And so she told my grandpa, okay, go to the Goodwill, find the biggest pot you can find. We're going to make pho in the garage. And so she opened up an underground eatery called Guan, Gui Hương, which means homeland cafe, in the garage. And it attracted a lot of the Vietnamese folks who also were relocated there as well. And so pho, right now people, usually in the U.S., people eat it for lunch or dinner. But pho is traditionally a breakfast food. So she opened it for breakfast before people went to work. And so she recreated like an eatery, an American or a Vietnamese breakfast in America.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
Yeah. So when I told my grandpa, who recently passed away, when I told him that I was doing this, he was just very happy. He's like, oh, just like grandma. I'm like, I know, grandpa.
So are you planning to go back into the above ground restaurant world?
Yes, I actually am building a restaurant right now called Good Girl Dinette. My supper series is called Good Girl Suffers. And the Dinette is a legitimate business. And it's going to be in Highland Park. I've actually gotten quite a few people who came to the suppers who said, what are you doing next? And I said, well, I'm looking to do this. So I cultivated some lenders along the way. When I sold my restaurant, it was a great thing. You know, I wanted to move on, but I realized I needed to have another restaurant.
Deep is the former owner of the Blue Hen restaurant in Eagle Rock. She's about to open the Good Girl Dinette. You can find out more on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. When two people from different cultures fall in love, there are often a lot of cultural misunderstandings to work through. Food is one way to smooth things over. When Good Food returns, I'll introduce you to a couple who go together like white on rice. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. So many things bring couples together, but nothing more resolutely than food. In fact, Todd Porter and Diane Koo are so close that their friends say that they stick together like white on rice. And that metaphor is pretty exact. In fact, that's what they called their blog. Todd and Diane are writers, travelers, teachers, and chefs specializing in Vietnamese food. Welcome, the two of you.
Thank you very much.
How did you guys get together? Did you have similar childhood experiences?
Actually, no. I think that's what really brought us together is that we have such different backgrounds, different families, and but yet we are so interested in other cultures and experiences that when we met each other, we kind of connected in that way, being so different but yet having interests in each other's cultures.
Superficially, almost everything is exactly opposite. At that point, she was a vegetarian. I grew up on a cattle ranch. Her obviously being Asian, me being just a classic white guy. But underneath that, there were a lot of, I guess, core similarities where both of our families had to work hard for their money, and they just developed great principles within us, and we learned from that.
So let's talk about banh mi, because every time I even think about banh mi, I get really, really hungry. To me, they're like one of the great, perfect sandwiches of the world.
I think it comes to just the Vietnamese cuisine does this a lot, where it becomes a perfect blend between the West and the East. You have the French influence, which is why they have the banh mi in the first place. And so you'll have this beautiful baguette, you know, light, crispy crust, soft enough, airy center that it just encases everything beautifully. You have a bit of the umami factor from the pickled daikon, carrots. You get a little pate in there. You have these beautifully grilled meats or cold cuts, whatever your preference is, where everybody can relate to it. At the same time, it has that slight exotic characteristic that we love from the Asian cuisines. So it's familiar, yet at the same time exotic, and you just can't get enough of them.
What are some of your favorite places here?
Gosh, there's so many in Southern California, and I think that's what makes us so lucky is because we have Little Saigon, which is expanding all throughout Southern California, and it's the largest conglomerate of Vietnamese outside of Vietnam. So the competition is great, and that's where I think the main focus is that there's so much competition, and everybody strives to make a sandwich better than their competitor. So the bread just becomes better and better. The filling becomes so much better, too, in terms of savory, and people start to get creative. But to really narrow down down where some of the best ones are, it's kind of hard because everyone is a little bit different based on, yeah.
What makes them different? Do most of the places prepare all their own charcuterie? Like, do they make their own pâtés in-house? Yeah.
Generally, some will. For the ones that we say is our favorites or what we like, a lot of them have in-house bakeries where they bake their own bread. Some of them will make their own pâté, some won't. As far as charcuterie, there are usually maybe one or two main companies where they get it from. But sometimes it's hard to tell because sometimes we eat them so fast, you know, it's hard to tell that, you know, you just like gobble it down so fast.
But like the grilled meats, all those are almost always done in-house.
Yes.
So it depends on what your favorite sandwich is.
It's overwhelming, yeah. Actually, mm-hmm. to choose. Yeah. So, Todd, what's your favorite way to order a banh mi?
Usually either the bún thịt nướng, which is basically the grilled beef, or you have the su mai, which is a meatball. Either of those two tend to be my favorite. It depends where I'm getting it from.
And what's your favorite way?
Oh, gosh. I guess it depends on where you go. But for me, I love texture. And I love, I love just the straight pâté because I love pâté and I love liver. But I would have to say probably the head cheese, which is usually thịt nguội. And it's a combination of head cheese and cold cuts because it's crunchy. It's got a lot of crunch and tendon factor in there, and I like that.
Now let's talk about spring rolls. How do you go about making the perfect spring roll? I've had moments where, you know, I'm pretty good in the kitchen, and I've just watched the wrapper just disintegrate right in front of me.
Well, I think the great thing about spring rolls is a spring roll is a gọi cuốn, which technically means just a salad in a roll. So you can take almost anything. So as far as the perfect spring roll in terms of filling, it's just whatever you want and whatever you have available. But the key to, I think, making a spring roll good is the roll. It's got to be tight. It can't be broken apart. And how you achieve that is with the rice paper, obviously. And working with rice paper can be tricky. People will disintegrate their rice paper by over-soaking it. And I think that's one of the fallacies that sometimes some people are teaching out there is you have to soak your rice paper wrapper, which essentially you're going to kill it. You know, you just need to quickly dip in some water. And that gives you at least the good core foundation for a good spring roll.
What Western traditions have you brought to the kind of cooking that you do as a couple?
Even though on our blog it's the Vietnamese stands out the most, we pretty much will cook everything. And she was like that before we met, and I cooked Asian actually before we met. But, you know, we'll do Italian, we'll do fresh pastas, you know, you're making our own tortellini. Of course, she's become like a little expert on steaks. And even though she used to be a vegetarian, she could pick out a better steak than most meatheads I know. She's not vegetarian anymore, though.
It's hard. It's hard to get really into food and stay pure.
Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah.
Well, it's been such fun having you, and I hope we get to have you back.
Thank you so much. It's so fun being here.
That was Diane Koo and Todd Porter. They are known as the White on Rice couple. They have a wonderful blog, and we will, of course, link to it on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm collecting fans on Facebook. Add me, Evan Kleiman, to your profile. Also, did you know that you can embed this show in your blog or webpage? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. You can read the Good Food blog there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Gary Messiha is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.